Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 71 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer, bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming, news and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. It's been another great couple of weeks of gaming here in the gaming capital of the world. How you doing, Cody?
Doing all right. Fall, I think, has arrived in the gaming capital. It's dropped a good 40 degrees from the start of the week to now.
I know, it was like 100 degrees last week, and now it's down in the 60s. It's like a little brisk chill in the air.
That's right. It's beautiful gaming weather. And you might notice we're talking about the weather because there's not much to talk about on the Colts end of things.
No, we got the bad news just today that Peyton Manning will not be starting the first game of the NFL season this coming weekend.
Yep.
That's pretty bad news on our account there. He was on my fantasy football team. I had both Mannings, Eli and Peyton, and now I'm going to have to trade him out for like, I got like Matt Hasselbeck or somebody.
Tavares Jackson. Yeah,
there you go. David Garrard.
Yeah. So we need to play lots of games and talk about games to get our minds off of what could be a very dreadful season in Indianapolis.
Right. And, you know, we have some kind of exciting news for this episode and actually for both of our episodes that are going to be released in September. We've mentioned to you many times, if you're a listener of the show, that our podcast is sponsored by Myriad Games. But for these episodes in September, we have actually taken on an additional sponsor, and that is Clever Mojo Games. Clever Mojo Games is the maker of Alien Frontiers, which we've talked a whole lot about on the show.
We love it.
As being just a great game, great dice rolling game. And they have some other really exciting things coming up in September that we're going to be talking about a little bit later on the show. An expansion for Alien Frontiers called Alien Frontiers Factions, and a brand new board game called Sunrise City. So look for us to be talking about, give you more information about that a little later this episode. But thanks to Clever Mojo Games for sponsoring these shows. You know, I think that's about all. Whoa, wait a minute. We haven't said what we're going to talk about this episode. What's going on this episode?
Well, we got such a great response from our Gaming in Public episode, last episode, that we're going to be going into the Game On inbox and picking a few of the many, many emails that came in about it.
Tons of them.
We might have to do another show about it.
It was amazing, the response. Yeah, so thanks for those.
And also in the inbox, we're going to visit the GM Academy. A few petitioners have some questions for me.
It's been a while. It's time to get the robe on. And open the hallowed halls.
That's right.
And we're also going to be doing a review of this new game from Z-Man Games. It's called Junta Viva el Presidente. It's kind of a retheming, reimagining of an older game called just Junta, and just a lot of fun. So we'll give you a full review of that guy. But it's all going to start with the rundown. Ready to do it?
Let's do it.
Well, it's time for the rundown, where we're going to tell you about all the gaming and geekery that we've been involved in for the last couple of weeks, and I'll start off with Cody. What you been up to?
Boom. I've played a few more games than last time, and I think I've remembered everything up front, so it should be a little less awkward.
Good, good. I don't see any piece of paper in front of you, though, so
all in the steel trap,
okay.
My friend.
Go for it.
I've played Quarriors a few times with several different groups, and it's funny because I still enjoy it.
Yeah.
The reaction has been very bleh.
Really?
Yeah, and I hate to use the word meh, but that's the word. That's the reaction's kind of been. Everyone's been like, it's okay, it's fine, you know. And I'd still enjoy it.
I like rolling dice.
Yeah.
I think it's fun.
Although they kind of put a burr under my butt because they've already announced an expansion coming in November.
Yeah.
New dice, new cards, everything. I mean, come on, guys.
Well, but I think that... Well, do you know about the details about the expansion? Because it's supposed to be like a cursed expansion, and that I think it's 20 new dice, but I think all those dice are like cursed dice. They're things that you can do and cards you can use or whatever to put bad dice into your opponent's bag. So,
okay.
Well, I don't know.
It's just too soon.
Really?
The game's not even been out 6 months.
No, it's not. It's not too soon.
It's incredibly too soon.
No, because
listeners, back me up. It's way too soon.
No, because all the people that were standing in line at Gen Con to buy up all these copies and all the buzz it's gotten and everything, they're playing the game and they're like, it's expansion time. And so they'll snatch up the expansion too. It's not like...
I hope that's not... You're you've gone on record saying you hate expansions.
I do hate expansions.
Well, then why do you want one coming out like 3 months after the main game?
I didn't say I wanted one coming out, but if they're going to put one out, then they should put it out right after the game comes out.
No, you got to wait a year minimum.
Don't be like Runebound where you're going to put an expansion out like 3 years after the game comes out. I mean,
did not need an expansion this early.
I agree it doesn't need an expansion at all, but I maintain that I do not like expansions to games because I feel like, in general, expansions are just fixing things that should have been fixed before the game went out in the first
place.
Not
always.
Not always, but... Or they're overcomplicating it. It's just my opinion. They're overcomplicating a game and adding things on and Frankensteining it. It doesn't need to be Frankenstein. But if you're going to put an expansion out, you put it out as soon as you can.
No, disagree.
It's all
way
about, it's
way
all
too
about
soon.
The money.
Way too soon. Anyway.
About the greenbacks.
Way, way too soon. Okay. So, played that a few times, gotten mixed reactions of it. I have noticed, and we talked about this last episode, if there's a dragon out, it's a race to the dragon. But I still don't think that's a terrible thing. I just, if there's a dragon out, it's pretty much you get enough Quiddity to buy as many dragons as you can, as fast as you can.
Yeah.
It's like saying, well, in Stone Age, you want to get the most victory points. Everyone's just racing.
How dare you?
It's like, well, that's
yeah.
The
in,
goal.
In Dominion, all you're really doing is trying to get the most money.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Well, you're trying to get the most victory points.
Well, via money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But no, I agree with you though. I mean, it's just, of course, there's going to be some brass rings in each of these games that you're going to want to grab for.
It's still a fine game.
It
Let's
is.
See. I played Elder Sign again, and its stock may be lowering a bit for me. I still enjoy it. But I played as a co-op. Of course, I played as a co-op.
We played the co-op version of Elder Sign.
I played the competitive version.
Is that an expansion for that game?
we played it at one of the Game On Game Nights, and it was really hard. It seems like the more I played it, the more the difficulties ramped up.
Yeah.
But I still just wasn't. I don't know. I found myself kind of falling into that co-op trap. I was becoming that guy. I was trying to direct traffic too much and. I don't know. I need a few more plays of it, but that was kind of an off-putting play, and I'm glad I got it in, but we'll see if I end up picking it up or not. Also got to try out Deadwood, one of the new Gen Con releases from Fantasy Flight.
Yeah.
It's like it and Black Gold should be its own like line of games. Like, they call it the Mayfair line or the Rio Grande line. Because
that's a great marketing idea to call it the Mayfair line.
it's games that Fantasy Flight has no business putting out because they just don't fit. They don't seem like Fantasy Flight games.
Yeah.
But Deadwood is a game set in the Old West, and it's really a worker placement game. It has kind of a modular board. It's got like a dice rolling mechanic for gunfights and stuff, but it's at heart, it's really just a Euro, with some dice elements thrown in. But it was a lot of fun, and I was annoying everyone at the game night because I was spouting out about every Western epithet I knew. And like,
I was at another table. You're asking me, John, you're from Texas. Do you know any cowboy insults? I'm like, no.
So it became
Woody from Toy Story.
There's a snake in my boot. Someone's poisoned the water hole.
Perfect.
Played that. That was fun. We got to try Rune Age. You taught me that.
Yes.
And I did not care for it. Fell completely flat with
once me. Again, our search for Cody for Deck Builder 2.0 and to replace Dominion, not found yet.
Oh, but I disagree, because we also played Eminent Domain.
Okay.
Which, spoiler, I really enjoyed.
Okay.
That was that of the deck builders, and it seems to be a very polarizing game. But of all the deck builders, I think that one, to me, has hit that deck building 2.0 itch. Like, I feel like I can see where this is based on Dominion. This feels like the next step.
Yeah. I think I
need to play it more.
Yeah, and we'll probably talk about that one. I think we may have a review of that one in an upcoming episode.
Yeah.
We'll see. But I think the cool thing about that one is that the deck building part of it exists, but it's not the focus.
Right.
Like, you feel like you're doing other things, and just as sort of a side effect, you happen to be building your deck at the same time. I like that one a lot too.
I still need to try that new Martin Wallace game, A Few Acres of Snow.
Yeah,
where it's like deck building, but in a war game.
Mm-hmm, that'd be
that would be interesting.
Yeah,
I believe that is everything I've played on the kind of geekery front. This is a segue here, but before I get into geekery front, I did finally play a 4-player game of the Game of Thrones card game.
Yes.
And it was fun. It just took too darn long.
That has been every game of that I've played. Is that it's fun. The mechanics are sound. The theme, if you especially like the books, is great.
Sure,
but
yeah. Yeah, it was a lot better this time around just because I kind of knew the characters and settings. But I think what I'm going to do is send this one on back to Myriad. It was a game share copy, and I'm going to wait for the Game of Thrones board game, which from everything I've seen, you know, playtime of 2 to 3 hours, got some, you know, some war game elements, some area control elements, some, you know, diplomacy-esque elements to it. I think that would be that scratches my itch for that.
Could be the could be the one. Could be your Game of Thrones
game. Yeah, yeah. And it should come out by the end of the year. So looking forward to that. So that is now all of my games. I'm glad John gave me the little wink there.
Yeah, it's sitting on the table here. Yeah. I'm kind of leaning over to Game of Thrones.
I'm reading Dance with Dragons. I know I said I was going to take a break, but I was in the car a lot this weekend, so I ended up reading a lot. Dance with Dragons, pretty good.
Yeah.
About a quarter of the way through, yeah.
Okay.
I don't see how he's going to finish the whole series in 7 books like it's planned.
Oh, okay.
I mean, unless, you know, big stuff starts happening, it just seems like there's a lot of loose ends. Because really, if you think about it, you know, think like Harry Potter or something, a lot of the stage was set at the end of the 6th book. You know, the 7th book was pretty much what happens here at the end, right?
Right.
It just doesn't seem like the series is kind of getting to that point, you know.
Only one more book to set that stage, right?
Right. And, you know, I'm fine with him adding more books to the series. I like reading his stuff.
Yeah.
I just worry he's not going to make it. I'm worried we might get a Robert Jordan here.
That's terrible.
I'm sorry. I'm just
George Martin's birthday is on September the 20th. Did you know that?
Yes.
I have a George R.R. Martin calendar in my cubicle.
Oh, is it on there?
And it's, I just turned to September, you know, and it's on there as a holiday. Wish I got the day off.
I hope the guy's not running out of time, but I want to see the end of the series.
It's terrible.
Sorry. okay. I think that is it on my geekery front. What have you been doing?
All right. Well, so I was at the same game night with Cody. I played Black Gold, which is the other one in this little sub-series that Cody's talking about from Fantasy Flight.
The not Fantasy Flight line.
Right. This is a game that's a remake of a game called Giganten that came out a number of years ago. And it's a game about prospecting for oil and building oil derricks and then taking that oil, kind of harvesting it. Is that what you do with oil? Harvest it?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Collect. You extract it.
That's what it was. Yeah, you extract the oil, and then you you can sell that oil at one of 3 different oil companies and that are represented on the board. I think this is a really great game that is flying under the radar right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it came out and, you know, it was on the Fantasy Flight website for like 2 days.
No one's talking about it.
No one's really talking about it, but I think this is a really solid game, and I think it fits very nicely into that sort of gateway pseudo-Euro category. Mm-hmm. You know, in the game, sort of the basic steps are that you're going to be moving a little truck around on the board. This is sort of like your little pickup truck that's surveying where the wells are and so forth. And you have these tokens that represent the wells. You can then build an oil derrick on those. And on the token, it says how many oil plumes you get. And this is where the components of the game are kind of cool, because you get these plastic oil derricks. And then there's a hole on the top of them. And then you have all these little oil plumes. They look kind of like black flowers. Mm-hmm. And they stack on top of one another. So when you set a whole bunch of them up there, it looks like it's, you know, bubbling up. Black gold, Texas tea. Mm-hmm. And you know, so you're taking your turns building all of these things, and then when you get to the extraction part, everybody pulls one plume off of each of their oil derricks, and then you can place them into the different locations where you would like to sell them. And so you could, you know, I'm going to put 2 plumes in Standard Oil and 2 plumes in this one. And then you're given a series of cards called sales licenses at the beginning of the turn. And it's variable depending on what kind of action card you select. They're kind of balanced out that you get like more movement and less sales licenses, or, you know, vice versa. So you have all these cards, and the cards themselves only have a 1 or a 2 on them. And these are kind of your bidding cards, because then you go over through a round of bidding as to who's going to get the right to sell the oil at a particular location. And so the bidding can be very tense, because you're looking at your opponents of, you know, how big of a stack of cards do you have? And even if you have a big stack of cards, are they 1s or 2s? Mm-hmm. You know, you don't really know how high you could go. You can bluff if you want to, but if you get caught bluffing, then you have to lose half of your cards, and then you're out, and you're not allowed then they redo the auction, and you don't get to participate. So we found that we played a 4-player game, and I found that it was just terrific fun, especially the
just terrific.
Just terrific fun. you know, we're singing the Dallas theme song, you know, and I think it just has all those great elements to it. You know, it took about 2 hours to play for a 4-player game, but we were also playing very casually. We were just talking and laughing. We weren't really focused yeah. in.
You can knock it out in an hour and a half.
Absolutely can knock it out in an hour and a half. I don't think any of the game is difficult for like non-gamers to really learn. So I think it fits in sort of that next step category after the gateway game. Someone plays Ticket to Ride and then, hey, you want to try something else? You know, maybe this would be
good
one
observation.
To try.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you guys haven't had a chance to check this one out, I would say, you know, definitely see if you can get a play in of Black Gold. So enjoy that one. We did play Rune Age. I've played that a couple times now, and I've actually played it 3 times. So I played 3 out of the 4 scenarios that are available in the game, and my opinion of it is kind of mixed. It's sort of in the middle. I see that there is a good game here. There's a good game that exists somewhere in that box. But I think the problem, well, let me say this. The cool thing about a game like Dominion, as far as deck builders go, is that you feel things building to a conclusion. From the very beginning, you know, you're building your deck, you're building that engine, it's starting to rev up, and then you see when people have really built their engine, they're cooking along, they're getting the 8 coins so that they can buy the province, and they're getting all the things that they need. You know, and it really starts to build to this conclusion. You can see the card stacks dwindling, and then boom, the game's over. You get your score. You know, this game I just sort of felt like it sort of hits a plateau and then just sort of cruises, and you just don't feel like the game's ever going to end. And it probably would end quicker if you had more experienced or skilled players. But I don't like any game that you have to play 4 times to be good at, and you know, to even be able to play competently at. That's just a personal thing. Mm-hmm. So. In this game, there's 4 different scenarios in the game. You can either play completely co-op, in which case you have a stack of event cards or like bad guys that you're trying to get through that stack of cards. And when you do, then that's going to that'll be the victory condition, is getting through the stack of cards. You have kind of a competitive race sort of version of the game, where you have like a dragon lord that you're trying to fight and destroy, and it's a race to see who can get enough strength to kill that dragon lord. You have a complete confrontational version called Rune Wars, where it's last man standing. You're basically attacking other players, and whoever the last person standing is the winner. And then you have also this one, which is sort of the more Dominion-like one, called the Monument, where every faction in the game, so every player, has a monument that costs a certain amount of money to build. And so the game is about getting enough money to be able to buy that monument on one turn. So, I mean, it seems like a lot of variety in the game, right? But and there is, and it's also cool because there's not just one currency in the game. Most games, like Dominion, just has coins as your currency. In this game, you have money, and then you also have influence, and you have like military strength. And so there's an interplay between these things where if you're buying military cards, those cost money. But then if you want to buy gold, that costs influence. And then getting influence requires strength, because the influence is gained by attacking cities, like neutral cities that are in the middle of the table, or attacking other players' cities. And so there's this back and forth of this limited, especially the influence resource, and where you're having to attack other players. And I just sort of felt like you get into this, you're building your engine, and you just get to this point in the game where, well, in order for me to get enough influence to buy the card that I want, I'm going to have to attack Cody over there. But Cody's got all this stuff out on the board. I'm probably not going to win, so I can try to do that. And you just sort of, I just felt kind of stymied.
It just got very bland very quickly.
Yeah, and then you're just like, can someone please get 11 coins so that, you know, we can build the monument and win, and we can be done with this. So I've heard people say that the game would be better with an expansion. Maybe. I don't know. Like I said, I think there's a good game buried in there somewhere, but there's some problems with it, I think.
And maybe. I don't know. It just came off. Like, Fantasy Flight decided they needed a deck builder, and they churned that out. Sorry, Corey. I like most of your stuff. It wasn't for me.
Probably so. So play those games. What else have I been playing? It hasn't been a whole lot lately, but that may be it. The main things were the game on game nights. Of course, we played Junto, which we're going to be talking about in a little bit, and the Game of Thrones card game, which I like, but it's just too long.
Yeah, I still like it. I just, yeah.
Yeah. One game that I actually did get to the table a couple of times with some different folks is King of Tokyo, which we did a review of a few episodes ago. Took that to a family reunion that we had over the Labor Day weekend, and I played that with my father-in-law and my son. We had a great time with that. And I also played a second game of that, just two-player, with my son. The big difference in that game with a two-player game is that since you have one player that's always in Tokyo and one player who isn't, there's not as much of a... which is kind of a back and forth with the King of the Hill thing of going back and forth there. It still works and it's still a lot of fun, especially I think you get a lot more with the card play, especially my son. He kept wanting to save up all of his energy cubes because he'd see the card going, an extra head, that's awesome, you know. But he really enjoyed it, and just, you know, he's 8 years old. He's kind of my benchmark now for, you know, that magical age of when, you know, when a kid can start playing these more grown-up games. And he did really, really well with it and really liked it too. I think he just liked the idea of the monsters and attacking each other and you know, getting the special ability cards. Another game that I got to play with my son, which is a game that I received at Gen Con from the designer. Actually, he just sort of came up to me and said, you know, can I give you a review copy of this game? And his name is Tim W.K. Brown, and he's produced a game called Gridstones. And this is a game that's been out for a little while now. It's from a Canadian company, and so like all the language in it is both in English and in French. But this is a really fun abstract strategy game.
Oh, look at you.
I know. You don't usually hear those words coming out of my mouth. Really fun and abstract strategy game. And what the game entails is that you have a grid of squares, and then you have a velvet bag full of little glass beads, and then you have a set of cards. Those are all the components in the game. Depending on how many players you have, you're going to play with a certain number of squares. More players means you'll have a wider, you know, larger overall grid. And then everybody is dealt out a certain number of cards. And what is represented on the cards is a particular 9-square grid with circles in a certain number of those squares. So let's say out of those 9, maybe the top 3 and then the bottom 3 are have circles in them. So your goal in the game is to, get rid of all your cards. But the way you're going to do that is you need to make matches on those on any set of 9 squares with the pattern that you have on your card. On your turn, you're either going to take a stone and put it onto the board, or you can remove a stone that's on the board. And then before or after that, you can also make a match with something that's already on the board. And so it's a very good pattern recognition game. Again, I played this with my 8-year-old son who beat me twice. And so he did a real good job of that. And so it's a really good game for his age. I think the box says like 7 to 77. So he's 8 and it works really well with him. But it's very quick to play. And, you know, it's very interesting the way you can rotate the cards. And I just thought it was great. Nice and fun and light. And I'm going to have to bring that one over so you can play that one as well, Cody. So thanks, Tim, for providing a copy of that. And I would definitely recommend Gridstones for anyone who wants kind of a light abstract strategy game. Component quality outstanding in this game as well. So I think that's about it. As far as other geekery goes, I've been watching more Doctor Who. I'm still in the middle of season 2 of the reboot with David Tennant. He's a very awesome doctor, gotta say.
How's Deep Space Nine coming?
It's looking really good on my shelf.
I've not started Doctor Who.
The case
either,
is so. Very dusty, but you know, I think it provides a little bit of aesthetic you know, excitement there. And as far as books go, I'm now reading the latest Dresden Files book that just came out like a month ago. I'm finally have caught up to the end of the series. Mm-hmm. So, and this is the book called Ghost Story. Which, not to give anything away, but it's very different. I mean, he's definitely going in this very interesting direction with the narrative. But it's still Dresden, still a lot of fun, so I'm enjoying that one a great deal. The only other one I have left to read after this is they came out with a series of short stories called Side Jobs that I'll probably pick that cool. one up and read through that guy. Then I got to find another series of books to read. So, listeners,
how about A Song of Ice and Fire?
I know. I got to read those.
You stalled out.
I did stall out. So maybe I should read that. Or hey, listeners, maybe you can tell me what series of books do I need to read next? I'm just started out with Guards from the Discworld series. So I want to read. I'm enjoying that one a little bit, but I need to finish the Dresden thing before
you need to get that on your Nook. Because I think you're like me, you read better on your e-reader than...
It's sad, but it's true that I feel like I do. Since I've gotten my Nook, I probably read 15 books on that thing in a year. That's more than I've ever read in my entire life. So I don't know what it is about having it there and having all the books available. But anyway, I've chattered on enough about all of gaming that I've been doing. I think that is the rundown. What do you think?
There it is. All right, before we get into the Game On inbox, as we mentioned earlier, we have an additional sponsor this month, and it is the great folks at Clever Mojo Games. Now, Clever Mojo Games, they're the people who kind of started this Kickstarter renaissance. It's like now you see all these games on Kickstarter trying to get funded. They started the, in my opinion, they started the kind of renaissance with it, with Alien Frontiers, which met and exceeded its goal, and they have a few new projects out here. One we're going to talk about, Sunrise City, which is up for funding now. And John, why don't you tell us a little about it?
That's right. Here in the month of September, Clever Mojo Games has launched two Kickstarter campaigns. One for the Alien Frontiers Factions expansion, which actually, as we were recording this, that has already met its funding goal and is going like gangbusters. So we're going to talk about that one in our next episode and give you some details about Alien Frontiers Factions.
Because you can still get in on the goodness.
You can absolutely get in on it. So we'll go ahead and just tell you now. You can go to Kickstarter, look for Alien Frontiers Factions, and support it. But we're going to give you more details about that next episode. So Clever Mojo Games also has another new great game called Sunrise City that they're doing a Kickstarter campaign for. This is a board game designed by Isaias Vallejo and has some great Art Deco illustrations by Sarah Chip Nixon, graphic design by Chris Kirkman. And Chris Kirkman is actually the graphic designer for the game Carnival, which is another kind of Kickstarter success story. This is a game that is all about city building. And so if you ever liked the game SimCity for the video game, you can sort of think of it as being like that, not as far as city management goes, but as far as building zones and then building buildings on top of that. And this game is going to have a great three-dimensional feel to it. It's a tile-laying game.
It's a game you want to play in public because it will catch some get some eyes, get some attention drawn to it.
Absolutely. And so it's got a role selection involved in it. It's also got tile laying and some auction and bidding mechanics. Now, these are all mechanics that they haven't just been thrown together. I mean, it's a very, very cohesive game and a very methodical game as far as being able to select things in such a way and bid on things so that you can get the most points. And you know, building these buildings is what's going to get you points in the game. It's got a really cool scoring system, which involves these things called benchmark tokens. It's got a normal scoring track of like 1 to 10 points, but when you cross that 10-point mark every time and sort of cycle back around, you'll get a benchmark token. If you're able to place your tiles in such a way that you land exactly on that top mark, on the 10-point mark, then you're going to get 2 benchmark tokens. So additional strategy built into the scoring system as well. So there's a lot of great stuff going on in this game. We've actually had a chance to play a prototype of this game, and we really like it.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun, and it sort of scratches that great sort of... we talked about Black Gold before from Fantasy Flight, but it's sort of that next level from a gateway game, mm-hmm. You know, where it sort of feels like it's got a little bit of extra complexity to it, but still something you can sit down and play with the family. So it's going to be having these really nice thick tiles that go along with, like Cody mentioned, you're going to be building the game as you go. And so it's really going to look slick. I think that once they get the final artwork and everything done for it, it's going to be a beautiful game. Now, one thing that you can do right now is you can go to Kickstarter.com and search for Sunrise City and support the game. There's, if you look on the right side of the screen, there's lots of different levels of support that you can do.
You can even get your image in the game.
Yeah, I think at the top level, you can actually get them.
That is really cool.
Yeah, there's lots of cool stuff like that. And you can also, this goes through September the 30th. So if you're listening to this in September, you have until then to support it. I think as we're recording this right now on September the, the 7th, 6th, they're almost like 80% funded right now. So, but you can still get in on it until the end of September. And also the one thing that the Clever Mojo definitely wants to mention is that they're offering some exclusive promo rewards for Kickstarter and Springboard backers. Springboard's kind of the retailer's version of Kickstarter, and that'll be launching after the Kickstarter campaign. But for your listeners out there who would be interested in Kickstarter, there's going to be promos that are some special community tiles and some special role cards that are going to be added to the game. And they pledge that these promo items are never going to be sold and will never be part of a Sunrise City expansion. So this is the only place you're ever going to get those. And they did the same thing with the Alien Frontiers. They had like the space crane tech card. And you're not going to be able to find that in any expansion. They've stuck to that. And so they're sticking to that same promise here. So if you want some exclusive promos and things you can't get anywhere else, go check it out. Clever Mojo, a really great game company. Alien Frontiers was a smash hit. And we think Sunrise City is going to do that too. So go and check them out.
All right, well, it is time for the Game On inbox. And like I mentioned earlier, we received a lot of response on the Gaming in Public issue, a lot more than I thought we would get. So much to where we might even do a follow-up here soon. We might see who we can get and do a discussion and tell John that there's more to libraries than just books.
Yeah, I really do want to have this discussion about gaming and libraries and you know, see who we might be able to get to come and talk to us with us about that, because I just don't think I understand libraries. Maybe I need to go back to the library and, you know, see what's going on there.
You should. But we picked a few of the emails from the massive, the overstuffed
That's right.
Game On inbox. And John, why don't you read the first one?
All right. This first message is from Robert Lee here in Indianapolis, actually. He says, "Hey, Cody and John, I just wanted to share my experience with gaming in public, specifically in a public library. One of my most memorable gaming experiences was created by gaming in the public library of a small backwater town in central Kentucky." Are there any other kinds of towns?
I was going to make the same joke.
I started playing D&D in 1982 in Louisville, and that's the proper pronunciation, by the way.
Yeah. Here in the Midwest, you have to say Louisville in as few syllables as possible.
Louisville.
If you can just go, that's probably you're pronouncing it correctly.
Anyway, he says his family moved to a town that he will just refer to as the armpit of Kentucky in early 2004. He says, "Since I didn't belong to the FFA club and could actually read,
ouch,
I didn't fit in well at all. It took a while, but I did find a few other outcasts with similar interests. We decided to start up a D&D campaign, but we couldn't find a safe place to play, since most of the parents from this abysmal pit of a town truly thought that playing D&D was a one-way ticket to an eternal lake of fire." Now we know that there's a couple stops along the way.
Yeah,
it's not
right.
It's not one way.
It's second edition, third edition,
yeah,
fourth
exactly.
edition. Yeah.
We knew that the public library had a meeting room, and after much debate, we decided to ask if we could use it Saturday afternoons. We all met at the library one afternoon, went inside, and immediately balked when we saw the quintessential librarian behind the desk, with her gray hair pulled in a tight bun, her horn-rimmed glasses resting on the tip of her nose, and her wrinkled fingers flipping through a card catalog.
Now, Kaylin has an action figure of, I think her name's like Nancy Pearl, librarian, uh-huh. And she looks just like that. She's got like the gray hair, the bun. She is shushing action.
Oh.
It's very nice.
It's like swivel arm battle
grip.
That's
right.
Okay. Do they still use card catalogs? Or is it all on computers now?
I don't know.
Again, so
I think most of them use computers, but I bet some of them just still have it as nostalgia.
We're just begging for a library episode, aren't we?
Things my kids will never even know about.
That's
the
true.
Card catalog.
Yeah, the rotary dial phone.
Yep.
After a few moments, I decided that the worst she could do was throw us out, so I approached her. "Hello, ma'am. My name is Rob. My friends and I were wondering if we could use the meeting room to play a game on Saturdays." Not even looking up from her task, she mumbled, "What game?"
Oh, she's an orc.
Yes. Well, she's a smoker. But I knew it was over. I guess we could play in a barn, which we had done a couple of times, or in someone's dingy storm cellar. With a discouraged groan, I mumbled, "Role-playing game, ma'am. You've probably never heard of it." She then finally looked up from her work, looked me in the eyes, and said, "Do you mean Dungeons & Dragons? My son plays that at college. I love that game."
She apparently quit smoking, too.
Yeah, well, you know, D&D cures emphysema. Anyway, she then exclaimed her love for fantasy and science fiction and how she believed D&D to be a great gateway, not to sacrificing babies to Satan, but to classic literature, mathematics, teamwork, and analytical thinking. She then showed us the public meeting room. It was much bigger than we thought it would be, with several tables, each large enough for 6 to 8 players. There was even a small attached kitchen with a refrigerator for our gaming goodies. Really?
I need to find this library.
Seriously. She then explained that the room was almost completely soundproof. We could get as loud as we wanted and it wouldn't disturb anyone in the main library. I simply couldn't believe it. I had found a gaming oasis in a desert of intolerance and ignorance. Being in the middle of nowhere, the nearest store that sold gaming supplies, called the Rusty Scabbard, that's a great name.
That is a good name.
Was 2 hours away in Lexington. None of us could drive yet, so the librarians ordered our gaming books through the library with the library discount.
That is fantastic.
Wow. If all that wasn't enough, they sometimes made brownies, cookies, or other goodies for us during our games. All right,
wow.
So we're going to move to Kentucky, I think. Almost every Saturday afternoon, other than the occasional town meeting that would kick us out, was spent in that library meeting room. We played the entire Dragonlance Chronicles and a few other classic adventures before my family moved again, this time to Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, Dragonlance Chronicles, that's like 13 modules, I think, from first edition.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you play through the whole trilogy of the Dragonlance Chronicles series.
That's huge.
Because everyone asked, you know. So
he wraps up by saying, if it weren't for this once-in-a-lifetime experience, I wouldn't have been able to stay with the hobby and may have succumbed to the rampant underage alcoholism and depression that permeates this small town even today. Oh, sorry, that's not funny. But my suggestion is to give your local library a chance. Though you may not have the stellar experience I had, it'll probably be better than rolling dice in a barn. thank you, Rob. That's a great story.
Yeah, and it's funny. I used to work with Rob when I did graphic design for Reebok back in the day, and he's a real cool guy. And we talked. We worked in two different departments, but we talked shop all the time. And great guy. And it was good to hear from him. Glad you're still listening, Rob.
That's great.
Our next email comes from Jesse Hickel. And he writes, I hope Scott Nicholson comes on the show to educate you about games and libraries. This is a topic I've been interested in.
Especially, you know, hold on. That first sentence looked like it should have been ended with, you dummy, John.
Yeah.
It has a little bit of a twinge to it there. I don't know. Well, anyway, yeah, I deserve it.
Maybe a little bit. All right. Especially since my wife has a degree in library and information science. My take is that libraries have been about more than books for a long time. You can get magazines, CDs, movies, internet access, and more. In order to maintain relevance in today's society, libraries have to be more than the stereotypical place for quiet reading with an old lady in a tight bun, giving you dirty looks and shushing you if you so much as cough.
That's hilarious.
Tight buns are getting a bad name here.
I know.
In the hair.
Don't hate the bun.
Don't hate the bun, indeed. Gaming is just one avenue to bring people into a 21st century library, which is really more of a media center now. Take care, Jesse, who says he's a lifelong Duke fan who's pretty sure God doesn't take sides in organized sports. He does when Duke's playing. Come on.
Oh, come on.
Duke? Really? It's like cheering for the house in poker.
That guy, Krzyzewski, who's the basketball coach, he's pretty good.
Krzyzewski,
yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that, thanks for the email, Jesse, and go Blue Devils, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's... I guess I come across as a bit of an idiot about with the library thing. But
I know.
It's not like I haven't gone to libraries. I go there for books, so I just didn't know all this stuff was available, so... Anyway,
there's a whole world out there.
A whole new world.
That's right.
A whole new world.
Next email.
Okay. Next email is from Adam Foster, who is writing us from Finland.
Beautiful Finland.
Tampere, I think, maybe, or Tampere.
Finland.
I don't speak Finnish. Adam writes and says, we have our regular gaming session in a pub, and there are normally five or six other groups playing as well.
Wow.
Occupying maybe a third of the total space available. The pub lets you book tables, making it a very gamer-friendly, and they also have a fairly decent library of games for casual players. We have regularly played Dominion, Betrayal at House on the Hill, Bang, XXXL. He says, watch the drinks.
I would destroy that. I mean,
play with the Hexen sticks.
I'm pretty aggressive with the sticks, yeah.
You'd have to play papers and glasses, I think. Race for the Galaxy, Seven Wonders, and Couriers will be added next time. A pub is definitely a great environment for more interactive games and can be a good way to introduce new players slowly. For example, you know, come along anyway. You don't have to play if you don't want to. You can just drink. always start with the more complex games and move to the simpler ones as the beers go down.
Good idea.
Wow, that's a good point. I've also played in pubs, restaurants during work conferences, and it's surprising how many gamers come out of the closet. Thanks for the great podcast. Cheers, Adam. That's pretty cool. And, you know, one thing I noticed, we mentioned pubs, but I think like our European listeners probably have a much better handle on that than we do because, you know, we have some bars and like the Clotta is an Irish pub here in town. It's like a chain restaurant more or less. But just that old-fashioned like going down to the pub and have a pint sort of thing, it just doesn't exist very much here in the States. It'd be cool, though.
The public house, you know, kind of feel. Yeah.
If I remember right, or if I understand right, you know, pubs in Great Britain and places like that, maybe this one in Finland as well, they're family friendly, right? I mean, you still can go down and have a drink, but that, you know, there's still, it's okay to bring, is it right?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I never really thought about that.
I don't know. European listeners?
Isn't the drinking age a little lower there?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know. We don't know anything. We're just like...
But I also think that it's much more accepted to have alcohol around children. You know, like here we really sort of cordon things up. It's even worse here in Indiana than it is in other states, I think.
Yeah.
Of, you know, you go into a restaurant with a bar and the under 21 kids can't even go into the bar area, much less, you know.
Well, in Indiana, you still can't buy alcohol on Sundays.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, so that's about where we're at. But that's a good idea. So European listeners, send us an email.
At the Game On Inbox, gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Or give us a call.
At 4138-GAME-ON.
And fill in our gaps there, because we don't know that much about European pubs.
Yeah, educate us on pubs.
I know. One more email we want to read this go-around. It's from Matt Morgan of Ocean County, New Jersey. And he says, "Hey, guys." That's how they say it.
Is that on the Jersey Shore?
I have no idea.
I don't
know. He goes, "Hey, guys. I thought I would share my experiences because both my game groups actually meet in very public places. First, I'm part of a weekly game night that meets at the local bowling alley in Ocean County. We play in the bar and grill area of the alley. The tables are huge, nobody minds our presence, and we pull about 10 people each week. This group plays everything and is not afraid to break out a 2-plus-hour big game on occasion. As for interaction with the bowlers, I've only been going for about 6 months, but the group has been meeting for much longer. In my time, we've only been approached by one old lady who wanted to know what we were playing. Perhaps all of the league bowlers are desensitized to the geeks who've been squatting in their food court for years."
I think it's funny, he says, you know, as for interaction with the bowlers, like it's, you know, you're the bowlers. The aliens or something, yeah. You know.
The other group is Nerd NYC, a gaming group in downtown Manhattan around the NYU area. We meet monthly at a cafe, Think Coffee, and attract 25-plus people, but focus on games with a small to medium footprint, preferably not longer than 60 to 90 minutes. This location does attract a lot of walk-in gamers and always has a good crowd. The coffee shop even has a wine bar.
Ooh, trendy.
Classy. Nerd NYC also meets quarterly for an all-day mini-con called Recess. Oh, that's kind of a cool name.
Yeah.
Where they rent out space in a dance studio / performance space. It's not uncommon to have 4 rooms rented out by gamers and another 2 rooms occupied by people rehearsing for a play or recital. Quite an odd mix, but there's little to no interaction. I don't think anyone worries about getting food on their games or being judged. We're all too busy having fun. Thanks, and keep up the great work on the podcast, Matt.
Wow.
That's a good line. We're all too busy having fun. I like that.
I still don't get food on my games.
Well, no,
I don't care how much fun we're having. Keep the food off my games. Right. Well, right. Thanks so much for those emails, and you know, keep them coming. We've got more that we want to probably read on our next episode a little bit, but we always love interacting with you guys. One of the best parts about doing this show is hearing what you have to say, because your opinions are usually more interesting than ours. And so we would invite you to write us at the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Or you can call the Game On Hotline.
4138. Game on. Place a bullet in the head. Murderer upon the bed. Safety gun. Suffering the scream and see. Sounds like dying. Everywhere I go, yeah. Everywhere I see. The black and blue uniforms. Police and priests. Take out the media. We have a bi trier tonight for you, and it's a. What would you call it? A Central American despot style game? If you were to put it in a Jones Theory hat?
I don't know what kind of bucket you put it into for Jones Theory.
Fantastic.
It's very different.
We're going to put it in the review bucket because we have a breakdown on Junta Viva El Presidente, kind of a remake of an older game, re-theming, I believe, too. I don't know a lot about the original. But Z-Man Games has probably the only game that you will buy that comes with a pair of sunglasses in Junta Viva El Presidente. Tell us about it, Jan.
That's Juan.
Juan.
All right, so Junta Viva El Presidente is a remake of a game.
That's my island music. Never mind.
Okay.
That's the second week of adding a little something to the beginning.
Okay, I want to see like some Jimmy Buffett to go along with this, because it's kind of, yeah. It's an island, you know. The idea in Junta, Viva El Presidente, is that, well, I'll even just kind of read it from the rules here, because it comes across pretty strong here. Some years have passed since the island República de los Bananas was convulsed by unrest and coup attempts. The military has become much less influential, and private militia now do the dirty work of rival families. The members of the junta live quietly in gaudy estates funded by their Swiss bank accounts. You belong to the junta and command a private militia. Rob your adversaries and sandbag the presidente in order to become president yourself. Rip off as much foreign aid as you can, hire more militiamen, and expand your estate. If you can do that faster than your rivals, you win the game. So this is a remake of a game that came out, I want to say it was like in the early 80s, 82, something like that. It was and this was the same kind of theme. It was, you mentioned we're asking if it was retheming. It's actually the same theme.
Oh, okay.
But in that game, a lot of it has to do with voting, where, you know, you're giving, the presidente is giving favors to the different players in hopes of getting their vote for certain things.
Okay.
This game has a little bit more to do with military conflict and the use of these militias. So the idea is that everybody, like it said, there is a belongs to this junta of these leaders on this island, and they command some sort of a militia. Everybody gets a board, like their own player board, that has this kind of comical picture of a like a compound where you've got your estate there with your house, and you know, you've got like military trucks all around it and things like that. And it's a victory point game in that the player who gets to 5 victory points is the winner. The way that you get victory points is by buying and upgrading your estate. So you might add a swimming pool, or you might add a guard tower.
I like the helipad.
The helipad, yeah, exactly. And if you can add it, each one of those things counts for a point, plus your estate itself counts for a point, and you're trying to get 5 points. So you'll start off, and one player will be the Presidente. And as Cody mentioned, this game is the only one that I know of that comes with a pair of sunglasses in the game. And it's the president. This is to denote who the Presidente is. So the Presidente will wear the sunglasses in any manner they want to. So, and they're going to be handing out cards. You have all these cards in the game. The Presidente will start off by handing out, by drawing cards that's number of players plus 2. This game plays 3 to 5 players. As the box says, 3 to 5 conspirators.
Conspirators.
Yes. And so the Presidente is going to look at these cards, and then everyone will be able to draw one card into their hand. And then the Presidente is going to go through a phase where he is going to make promises to his loyal subjects.
His golpistas.
His golpistas. That's right. All the people who aren't the Presidente are called golpistas. And so the Presidente has to give at least one card to every player, but he can choose to give more if he wants to, and then he can keep the rest for himself. And so these cards might represent a lot of different things. There's cards that do different actions that will help to make military stronger. We'll talk about the militias in a second, but will help in combat. There are also cards that are called foreign aid cards, which are just worth pesos, millions of pesos. And so these are money cards. So you're kind of bribing, the Presidente is bribing his golpistas. And why is the Presidente bribing the golpistas?
Why is the Presidente bribing the golpistas?
Por qué? Well, because...
Por qué?
Well, because there's going to be some military conflict in here, and the Presidente needs to be protected. And so he's trying to buy some protection from the golpistas that are around him. Because what's going to happen then is that after all these promises are made, then each player has to decide how they want to command their militias. Now, the militias are represented by dice in this game. Everybody gets 1 to start off with. And everybody's player board also has a particular die face on it, a particular number, and every number except for 6. And so the idea is you have a choice with your militias that you can either attack someone else, in which case you'll turn that militia so that it faces the player that you want to attack. You can choose to defend yourself with that militia, in which case you'll put your own number onto that die. Or you can choose to defend the Presidente, because maybe he gave you some really good bribes.
Maybe he took care of you.
He took care of you, yeah. And you want to be loyal to him and show your loyalty. In which case, you will put your die to the number 6. And you get these cool little player screens, which look like a military personnel vessel or a vehicle with a banana on the side of it. So if you didn't get the idea already, this is a very comical, lighthearted, fun sort of a game. So
this is a gritty, realistic interpretation of warfare.
Really, the picture on the box is like this kind of silly-looking military dictator leader getting smacked in the head with a red die. So that's kind of fun. So you're going to secretly choose what you're going to do with your militias. And then everybody is going to reveal the militias here. And you get to kind of see who is going to be attacking who. And so then you'll go through a series of combat steps. And that's going to start off with who is attacking the Presidente. Now, one nice thing is that if no one chooses to attack the Presidente, and everybody decided to be loyal, then everybody gets their promise cards immediately. So it's like, you know, the Presidente's cool, and he's safe, and so everyone gets their promises. But that's not likely going to happen too often. And so what you'll start off with is whoever is attacking the Presidente. And so the way the combat sort of works in this game is that the Presidente is not allowed to use his militias for anything other than defense for himself. And Presidente can play cards. There's a defender cards that can change the value of dice and things like that. But the Presidente's militias only count, each of his militias count for 1 point of defense. So if he has two militias, that's 2 points of defense. Plus, he gets a point for his actual estate. So whatever number his estate is, he'll get one for that. And so then the attackers will have an opportunity to play cards. And let's say multiple players decide to attack the Presidente. They'll each have an opportunity to play cards to affect the outcome. And so then all the players who are attacking are going to roll their dice, and all the players defending are going to roll their dice. Now, like I said, the Presidente will not roll his militia dice. Each die will just count for one. Each one will be one, add one to his defense. And he's going to add that to all of the players who choose to defend the Presidente are going to roll their dice, and whatever numbers those come up, that's the total defense value. And then there'll be a total attack value. And so... basically, if you're attacking the Presidente, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to have a successful attack, in which case, if the attack value is if the attack value is less than or equal to the defense value, then the attack was unsuccessful. If it was higher, then the attack is successful on the Presidente. In which case, if the attack is unsuccessful on the Presidente, then all of the players who did not attack the Presidente will receive their promises. Everyone else will not. Anyone who attacked the president will not get promises.
So there is an incentive to stay loyal to the stable government leader.
Extremely stable government leader, yeah. But if the attack on the president is successful, then you're going to look at whichever player has the highest, what they call personal combat value, which is the value of
PCV.
Or PCV, which is the value of all of their dice that they roll, plus any cards that they play that modify their dice. They are going to become the new Presidente at the end of the round. And so that's you'll start off with that battle against the Presidente. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
I played it.
Well, I know. And so then you'll proceed around the table to all of the other players and see which other players are being attacked. And you're going to go through this same combat step with each of those players too. Playing defense cards, playing attack cards, rolling your militias, and then figuring out the outcome. One other thing to mention is that if an attack is successful, then every attacking player can plunder by taking a card from the defender's hand. So in the case of attacking the Presidente...
At random,
yeah. Then you're going to start off with a player who has the highest PCV, personal combat value.
See, there you go.
It's not PCV in the book. Cody just made that up. They're going to get first pick to take a card. And you may get to the point where maybe the three people attack the Presidente, and the Presidente only had two cards to begin with. Well, the third player, who's lowest, he's out of luck. But that's how the plunder is going to work. And getting these cards are important. The reason why you're getting all these cards is because you're trying to get money. Because the very last step of this of the round is the spend money phase. And if you end up with no militias, if your militias get destroyed, then you're going to receive one militia for free. And then you can spend the money that you may have gotten from cards on different things. So it costs 4 million pesos to build a building, which one of the little tokens that you'll get a point for in your compound. 2 million pesos will buy you another die, will buy you a militia. 1 million pesos will buy you a card, just a card from the deck there. So cards and militias and buildings, those are the kind of things that you're going to be buying. And then at the very end, the last housekeeping thing you do is that you can have only 4 cards, so you have to discard down to 4 if you have more than 4 cards. So the game will just continue, starting off with whoever the Presidente is at the beginning of the round will deal out those cards, make the promises, and you'll continue this on until someone achieves 5 victory points. There's an advanced or expert game that adds a couple of other elements where you can actually promise militias to other players, the Presidente can, in addition to the cards. And also that game is played to 6 victory points, in which the sunglasses also count as a victory point. So if you possess those, then you get a point
too. They already count as a victory point in life.
That's right. And so we played did we play a 5-player game of this? Or was it? It was 5.
It was 5.
Played the full game of that with Cody, Kalen, Greg, and Morgan. And Cody even brought in some additional accoutrement to go mm-hmm. with the sunglasses. We had the hat mm-hmm. and the scarf, right?
That's right.
And you had to have the right pose, you know.
That's right. You had to have the hands up like, eh.
Kind of the Alberto Del Rio WWE pose there. And so that's Junta Viva el Presidente. So, Cody, what did you think of this game?
I really liked it. I had no idea of its existence, really. And when you brought it over... I guess I'd always thought Junta, I piled it in with all the Euros that I don't play. I'm like, oh, it's like Brass or Kalis or all these one-word names.
And not
that,
even close.
Yeah, no, all right? And we played it, and it was a light game. There was a bit of depth in there, but, I mean, it was a great social game, and, you know, I just had a lot of fun with it. I thought the idea was interesting, and, you know, any game that go so far as to provide a little prop or something, just that little extra something, because they didn't have to have the sunglasses. They could have just had this little cardboard token or something that
right,
says
right.
You're El Presidente. It was done very well, and I just had a good time with it. It was one of those where you just relax and enjoy it.
Yeah. You know, in our show, we do buy points, try points, and deny points to help you decide whether this game is right for you. For me, buy points, the sunglasses.
Yes.
I mean, that's worth the price of admission right there. I think the component quality is excellent. Mm-hmm. You know, the artwork is very fun and very themey. And I love the social aspect of the game that... At its core, it's a dice rolling, card playing sort of a game. But, you know, you just sort of find yourself, especially if you're the Presidente, you know, speaking with an accent and going, my friends, you have to, I don't even know what kind of accent, but, you know, it could be, maybe it's a French Republican, my friends, you have to help me, you know, be loyal, you know, or whatever. And it's just terrific fun to see, you know, who's going to be the Presidente and who's going to get attacked. And any game with a little bit of light backstabbing, I think, is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So those are my buy points for you.
The sunglasses as well. And kind of like you said, it's a light kind of backstabbing game. You know, probably wouldn't take more than an hour, all said, but it's just a lot of fun for what it is, and I think it'll be a fun time every time you bring it out.
Try points for me would be the fact that it is this kind of a fun social game. Folks who would shy away from something that has that social element to it, they may not like the idea of having the sunglasses and playing. I mean, sure. It's not a role playing game at all. But I mean, you kind of can play that role. You can play it up as much as you want to.
Yeah.
Folks who aren't interested in that kind of fun, you know, might not think it's very interesting. It's a theme that's kind of out there. I mean, the idea of military dictators in our time, like Manuel Noriega and, you know, Gaddafi, you know, mm-hmm. is very timely right now. There's some very serious, like Gaddafi right now, that's a very serious thing in our history. But if you look back at, like, Manuel Noriega, or what was the other guy, Ferdinand Marcos, you know, mm-hmm. these, it's almost, they do have sort of a comical feel yeah. to them in retrospect, you know, with given enough time. And, you know, so, but if that theme doesn't interest you, then, you know, you're probably not going to get into this game.
Yeah, and my only try point would be tack onto that. This is a... Even though lightly so, it is a confrontational game, and it can be kind of, if you are the Presidente, if you are the leader, you will get, you know, a lot of people will start to gang up on you. Maybe not at first if you're promising them nice stuff, but eventually it is kind of a jump the leader sort of thing. So if you don't like the confrontational aspect, that may be something to check out with it. But I think it's done pretty lightly. It's not... You know, it's not like diplomacy or intrigue levels of, you know, stabbery,
yeah.
but...
Oh, yeah. No one's going to be, hopefully, no one's going to be running out of the room, you know, being upset. You
yeah.
know, that would be good. Only deny point I can think of is that the sunglasses I got with my game broke pretty quickly. And, you know, so I don't know. I mean, that's...
The Banana Republic is not known for its sunglasses.
That's, I could probably tape them up and that would actually be even more themed. Yeah. But, you know, so they're just a cheap pair of plastic sunglasses. So you can replace those with mm-hmm. whatever you want to represent the Presidente. So no big yeah. deal there.
No deny points for me. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Okay, this one retails for $40, I think, from Z-Man Games. Really fun one. Junta Viva el Presidente.
Welcome to the GM Academy, the premier institute of higher learning for both role players and game masters alike. Send your RPG queries and petitions to gameoninbox@gmail.com. And now, please welcome the Chancellor of the GM Academy, Cody L. Jones, Esquire III.
That was classy.
Did you like that?
Very nice.
Yes, yes.
Well, we are stepping it up now.
It was. You are worthy of it, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Well, so are you ready? We have a couple of petitions to the GM Academy episode. Are you ready? Are you ready to receive them?
I'm ready.
All right. The first is from Matt Evans from Arlington, Washington. He writes, "Hi, Cody and John." I think he really just means you.
Oh, hello.
He says, "Love the podcast and really appreciate your last episode about Gen Con." He says, "I feel very jealous not being able to make it out there for what sounds like a great convention," but he's apparently been working for the Boys and Girls Club and doesn't get to travel a lot.
Oh, okay.
So, anyway, he's writing to ask some questions for the GM Academy. He says, "I am slowly learning how to be a GM for Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition. I have DM'd a season of encounters at my local store, Phoenix Games, in Mukilteo, Washington? Yeah, I've never heard of that town.
I need to get a new administrative assistant here at the GM Academy.
You need to start paying
Preferably me. One that can read.
You need to start paying me better. And was a DM for the latest Worldwide Game Day. I want to start creating my own campaign, but not sure where to start. Any advice on creating a campaign from scratch? The biggest hurdle I have is creating the encounters and creating the map for said encounters. Any help would be great. Keep up the good work."
Okay. Well, you can come at this a few ways. If we're talking about creating a campaign, a lot of time that's kind of wrapped into making a world as well. Mm-hmm. And there's really two schools of thought on it. There is the kind of small to big idea and then the big to small. So the small to big is like you start your work on the starting town, the starting city, the starting whatever that your players will be in from level one. And you
have the tavern where they all meet.
Sure, right. And you have that pretty detailed. You know, yeah. You have that detailed enough for play. And then the rest of the world is kind of, you have a rough idea. You know, you might have, there's this continent over here and it has an Asian flavor to it. Or, you know, this is kind of like, you know, medieval Europe up here and it's ruled by vampires or something. You just have like really brief couple sentence things. And then as the
Asian flavor, medieval Europe ruled by vampires.
Well, that's just two quick ideas, you know.
Wow. I mean, you're brilliant, sir.
No, shut up. Anyway, this insolence will not.
I'm just amazed. Go ahead, please. No, continue.
Anyway, there was Oriental Adventures, the source book in first, and there was Ravenloft. Shut up. Okay, so anyway, you start with that detail, with that one town or whatever, and then kind of as the PCs and as the party and as the story branches out, you kind of take that detail with them. And so, like, you really don't need to have all these statted out areas of a land that's like 3,000 miles away in the world that they'll never even go to.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, it might be neat for you, but, you know, they're not going to use it. The other idea is that you start with kind of a big idea on the world, and you shrink it as you get to where the PCs are. That's kind of the more work involved. I prefer the small to big when it comes to world building. Now more on the campaign level. You mentioned that you're a D&D 4th edition, so this kind of works out nice. It has three tiers of play. It has the heroic tier, which is 1 through 10, the paragon tier, which is 11 through 20, and epic 21 through 30. That's really nice because you can have kind of one overarching story, and you can, you know, just boil it down to its necessities. Say, is it, you know, like big bad evil guy threatens to destroy the world, or is it more the PCs just go around and are looking for fortune and glory, whatever. Just get the basic idea of your campaign down. So let's say, for example, it's big, bad, evil guys trying to destroy the world, okay? So in heroic tier, you know, break that big story down into three smaller chunks. And this can work with any game system. It works pretty nice with 4E because it's built into it. So the first one could be maybe they're encountering some raids on villages and they're not sure where the raids are coming from. And maybe the big, bad boss of that first tier is some lieutenant of the big bad evil guy. And there in that heroic tier, the PCs kind of, they learn about the existence of this big villain and what he plans to do. And, oh man, this is a lot bigger than we thought it was. So then in paragon tier, you know, that can be something where they're trying to get they're doing research on this guy. They're trying to find his location. They're trying to find a weapon or an item that can be used against him, something like that. And then that can culminate with getting the item, finding the location, something, and involve a big fight doing that. And then an epic tier you've built up to where they're going to this location. Maybe they're entering this final stronghold and having this big epic fight with whatever this big bad evil guy is in the end. So really, you're just taking a base concept, breaking it down into three or four chunks, and then you can write it from there. And you really don't even have to do that much work. You know, if you're starting at level one, you know, chunk that out like that, and then, you know, just go one adventure at a time, because the PCs will do things that throw you off anyway. So yeah. If you just have just a very loose idea of what you want to do, you can tailor locations as you see fit.
Now, in a situation like that, where you talked about the Paragon level, the Epic level, mm-hmm. when you build a campaign, do you kind of begin with an end level in mind? I mean, if you don't intend for your if the players don't think that their characters are ever going to get up to level 20 or level 15 or whatever, mm-hmm. you know. Is it possible that you're never going to get to that big bad? How do you kind of tweak that?
Sure. I have like a loose idea. You know, okay. It's like I may say, okay, this I intend for this adventure to go to level 25, 26 or whatever. But I more have the end point in mind. And if you know, I'm not going to pad the story just to, you know, if they're at level 22 or 23 and they're getting to the point in the story where they're, you know, the next room is the big bad evil guy. I'm not going to like pad the story to where they have to do stuff for two more levels just because I said 25, you know. Oh, yeah. I'll stat out the big villain at an appropriate level. And this kind of dovetails into his question, how to build encounters, how to build maps. Fourth edition and a lot of games like it have a handy way to build encounters. I think if you check out the Dungeon Master's Guide for 4th Edition, it tells you how to like develop an XP budget, and you can make a really balanced encounter with that. I think in the book it even tells you, you know, say there's 10 encounters per level, you might have 7 that are, you know, equivalent to, you know, a normal challenge of a fight. You might have 1 that's easy, kind of like a warm-up encounter, and then you might have 2 that are difficult. You might have 1 that's difficult and 1 that's really difficult, kind of like an epic boss battle, you know, because... Yeah. The players, you know, they'll get bored just having kind of normal fights. It's good to have something that really kind of raises the blood pressure and makes them invested in the victory.
If they're not fearing a TPK, then you're doing something wrong, right?
Right. You know, we don't advocate the adversarial GM on the show, but also we don't want your players to walk all over you. You know, the bigger the challenge, the bigger the reward.
Right.
And finally, you mentioned kind of like making the maps. Really don't stress out so much over it. The two things to remember, and this will be kind of 4th edition centric, is you want it to you want it to be big enough. You may think that, you know, like, oh, like a 8-square by 8-square room, that should be big enough for the party. It seems big, but once you get down into the combat, you'll find that's really small and constricting, and you want some room for your monsters and your characters to play in. So you know, kind of make it big depending on the size of the party, and don't be afraid to add some elements, add some difficult terrain, add some of the fantastic terrain that D&D 4th edition has, like blood rock or ice or fire or something like that. You know, don't have everything in a dank stone floor. You know, really mix it up. And 4th edition even has rules for making the environment part of your XP budget and part of the challenge. You know, if there is a pit that has to be jumped across or slick terrain that requires an acrobatics check, you know, put all of that in there and make the challenges not only come from the monsters but from the room and the environment themselves, and you can have a really dynamic encounter that... that kind of challenges the players on not just a straight ahead martial level.
Now, do you like to, in general, just use a mat with a wet erase marker to draw out your maps on a player mat, or do you use like a computer program to? Because there's some good computer programs out there.
Actually, doing the maps, I prefer Paizo in their Game Mastery line puts out a product called FlipMat, and it's really nice. Usually, it has They have different flavors of it. They have like a dungeon one, they have a city one, they have a wilderness one. Usually it's plain squares on one side and some sort of pre-rendered terrain on the other, and I just use the square side. The nice thing about the flip mats is they fold up, they're easy to transport. You can use wet erase, dry erase, even permanent marker on them, and it handles it all pretty well. The old fogey in me kind of likes the old wet erase maps. I like the look of them, but they can be kind of a pain to administer at the table because you can only use wet erase on them, and you have to spray them down and wipe them down between map changes. Mm. One other thing, if you're I just saw this, if coming up with terrain ideas is kind of challenging for you, in the same line, Game Mastery has these they have these things called map packs, which are I would say maybe 5x7. It's hard to tell the size when I'm looking at them here.
They look really cool.
Yeah, they're really, but they're basically these pre-printed locations that are on kind of this cardstock paper, and you can use, they connect to make big scenes, or you can use just one thing of them for a combat. So it's pretty neat. It's they have, you know, lairs and villages and caves and stuff like that. So, you know, for like 10 or 12 bucks, you can pick up a pack of these and have, boom, you have a lair ready to go, or boom, you have a town ready to go. So that's another option you can go. Paizo's Game Mastery line has a lot of really good stuff that can help you out there and give you ideas for what you want to do in the future as far as building maps for encounters.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thanks so much for your question, and hopefully that'll help you out. And, you know, as you're building your campaign, please drop us a line, let us know how it's going. All right, we have one more question.
Okay.
It's a twofer.
Oh.
Question here in the GM Academy from Brian Symington from Santa Monica, California.
Friend of the show.
Oh, yeah. And he says, here's a question for the Game Masters Academy, GM Academy, uh-huh. Sir,
yes.
Officially. How can I get GMs to acknowledge subtle character play? A couple examples. In a game of Serenity, I played Simon, and in a game of Angel, I played Wesley. I'm not familiar with Angel. Have you played Angel before?
No.
Is that like the...
I think it's based on the TV show.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Very good. I thought I played both characters really well, keeping to their motivations and personalities. Both are serious and somewhat taciturn, so I feel like my play was overshadowed by more outgoing characters, such as the persons playing Lauren in the Angel game. To be fair, he was really funny and was perfectly in character. How can I get the GM to recognize my play? Thanks.
That's tricky. I mean... you know, a lot of that falls on the GM because, I mean, in a perfect world, yeah, you're playing your character 100% correctly, but, you know, the attention is going to naturally go to the more outgoing characters.
Yeah, I know. When I played a Serenity game at Gen Con where we played the TV characters, and I played Jane.
Yeah.
And, I mean, of course, Jane's like the big outgoing, so I was really playing it up. And I could see how the person who was playing Zoe... she was doing a very good job of playing that sort of tense, you know, side, you know, right hand man kind of a thing. But, and we had a good GM, so she was making sure to take care of everybody. But I could see how it could be overlooked by me, you know, making big, loud, crass comments the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question because it, you know, you're doing really all you can do. That's up to the GM, and especially in systems like Serenity or, you know, even for Ubiquity, Hollow Earth Expedition or Savage Worlds. You know, there's a built-in reward system where, you know, GMs can reward play even if you're playing the more quiet character and you're doing it, you know, you're doing it correctly. You're not doing it because you're off texting on your phone or you're just not engaged in the game. You're playing the character you've been given. You know, I had that a few Gen Cons ago where I was trying to play this professor in that awful Hollow Earth game we played.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I was playing him as written and the guy just wasn't giving me any style points or anything for it. And, you know, it's just, well, there's nothing I can do about it. You know, I just got to kind of swallow it up and play the character, do what, have fun.
Now, let's say if you're playing in a campaign or something, let's say he's playing a Serenity campaign as his character, and week after week, he's not getting recognized. He's not getting any, what are they called in Cortex? It's not plot points. Uh-huh. You get plot points and he's not getting any of those. He's not, you know, he doesn't seem to be recognized.
Okay, sure.
Is there a way to talk to your GM without sounding whiny? You know?
Oh, absolutely.
Because I think I'm the kind of personality that I would just kind of
get depressed about it.
Well, but I would just deal with it and just say, ah, that's just kind of how it is. But I could, you know, I think, you know, I'm just not a confrontational person usually.
Well, so. Yeah, I accepted the question on the premise that it was, you know, a con game. But you bring a good point. If it's if it's an ongoing campaign. You know, really don't be afraid to talk to your GM, especially if they're running, you know, one of these style games that are kind of more role-playing driven anyway. Because GMs, the best thing you can do for a GM is be interested in their story. And when a player comes up to you and says, oh, I've got this idea for my character or this world and something, that will brighten most GM's day. So I think if you just, you know, do it like an adult, say, you know, I've been playing my character. What do I need to do to be more rewarded? I feel like I'm doing X, Y, and Z correctly. Is there something I'm missing on your end?
Or make it like a question. That's a good idea.
Yeah, you know, you don't be like, you know, you suck. I'm doing all this stuff, and you're not. You know, be like, hey, I'm doing my best here. I think I'm really hitting these points. What can I do? You know, put a spin on it. You know, sure. put the HR spin on it. But yeah, you know, just talk about it and talk about, you know, how's my character really fitting in your story and your world? You know, kind of buff their ego a little bit.
Sure.
But GMs love talking about that. And every time I've seen something like that, you know, I've been in long campaigns where, you know, it wasn't really so story driven like D&D first edition, but, you know, I thought my character really didn't have a place, and I'd go to the GM and I'd say, hey, you know, I just don't feel like I'm fitting in. And, you know, he might say something like, I know this has been a down spot for you, but the story is going to take a turn where your character is going to be much more important. So just hang in there, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The spotlight will swing back around to you. Or, hey, you know, he might give you tips. That's, you know, you might not see it because you've got those blinders on and you think you're doing everything perfectly right. So
definitely
keep that dialogue with your GM open outside of the game, and you'll find that his game will get better and your game will get better as well.
Yeah, you know, I have the Rogue Trader campaign that I ran, the one campaign that I've mm-hmm. I've run, had one guy in our group who was playing Astropath, and I think because we were all new to the setting and new to the rule set, he didn't really understand what an Astropath was supposed to do or all the stuff that it entailed and his backstory and everything, and he kind of came to me with some concerns of, I just don't think that this is, I should have picked this differently, I should have picked this different ability, and, you know, and he was really unhappy with the way he'd built his character. And And granted, we were playing a very small, you know, 4-session campaign, but you know, I was able to kind of encourage him and say, you know, there's going to be a place for you, you know, to contribute. And it ended up that, you know, because he's sort of the navigator of the ship, there was a lot of kind of interesting and what ended up being kind of funny things that happened as a result of his play. So sometimes just even encouragement that you're doing a good job.
Stick with it. Yeah.
Just stick with it. Yeah. But yeah, that's very good advice there. So Brian, hopefully that will help you in your upcoming games. And I think that is the GM Academy for this episode. We will close the doors of the hallowed halls, but the doors may be closed, but the mailbox is always open.
Very nice.
You can send your petitions to the GM Academy at the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Chancellor Jones always available to answer your questions. And you can also call the Game On Hotline.
4138. Game on.
Well, that was some gravitas there in that presentation.
I had to take off the robes and the hood.
Very nice. All right, so that's the GM Academy for this episode.
Thanks for listening to another magnifico episode of Game On with
Mis Golpistas.
Bananas.
That's right.
Other items.
What's the Spanish word for banana? Oh, yeah. Banana.
Banana.
Well, Wayne's going to tell you all the ways that you can get a hold of us. You know, when we've been mentioning that throughout the episode, we love to get feedback from you guys. Join us in 2 weeks where we're going to be bringing you a Game On tradition,
mm-hmm.
a yearly tradition, and that is the top 11.
This, very excited.
The 11 in 2011.
Sorry, we go to 11. It's one more.
One more than the normal 10 that's done on other media.
That's right.
But we'll be giving you our list for 2011 of our top 11 games of all time. And there might be some shakeups. I don't know. I've been working on mine, and there might
yeah,
be
I don't
some.
Know. Mine's looking pretty different, so
yeah,
we'll
yeah.
see.
But in addition to our great sponsor, Myriad Games, we'd also like to, again, thank our new sponsor for September, Clever Mojo Games, who are launching some Kickstarter projects for their great new games, Alien Frontiers, the Factions expansion, and also Sunrise City. So we'd encourage you to go and check out Kickstarter.com and support those great games. When you support great games, then you get great games.
Yep.
You know? So thanks to
yep.
yep. So thanks to Clever Mojo Games. And hey, until next time.
Game on.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games, on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at GameOnPodcast.com. Join our guild on BoardGameGeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at GameOnPodcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on PulpGamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On.
All right, it's time for the...
Is it now? Is it really?